Okay. Can you tell me about the relationship between the two squadrons?
We were friends, but we were sort of friendly rivals.
Yep.
I don't know what we had to be rivals about because we were all there doing the same thing, but it was sort of, we're better than you.
Uh-huh.
We used to do little nasty things to one another.
Do you remember any of those?
Can
you talk about any of them?
Well, we managed to steal their squadron commander's Jeep and paint it our squadron color, Kelly Green.
Okay. That probably didn't go over very well.
Well, they retaliated. They painted one of our buildings red.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, little things like that.
Sure.
We'd get together and drink. And,
sure.
But it was a friendly rivalry.
Now, I was going to ask you about the different the facilities that you were describing, the tennis courts and all. Did you use the pool?
Used the pool. Uh-huh. Played tennis a few times. We had a basketball court in the parking lot out there that we played a lot of basketball.
Uh-huh.
We at one time started flag football teams, and they made us quit because we kept getting hurt.
Yeah. How long did you actually get to play football before somebody put the...
Not very long, probably 3 weeks at the outside.
Really?
I mean, we hurt somebody pretty bad.
Oh, did you?
Tore an Achilles tendon or something.
Ooh, ouch.
So
yeah.
They made us quit.
Okay. And they were... presumably, they were trying to get you to keep focused on the mission by not getting, you know, don't get injured so you can't fly.
That's right.
Can you tell me about the first mission that you actually did in the country? Do you remember it?
I remember more the first time that I flew an actual night combat mission.
Okay, can you tell me about that?
Because that was the first time I think I was ever sort of concerned.
Okay.
Because it's dark.
Right.
And I remember... I was with a guy who had been there for a little while. It was so obvious it was right at the very start. I wasn't flying with Jerry Gray.
Okay.
But we had a target, and we had a forward air controller, and we kept rolling in, and I kept telling him, I think they're shooting at us. And finally, I heard him come and say, that's the moon reflecting on the water. They are not shooting at us.
Uh-huh.
But that's the one I remember the most.
You were a little bit concerned there.
After that, I said, well, I'm not going to be afraid anymore.
Can't be afraid of the reflection, huh?
That's right.
Okay. What kinds of weapons were you loaded up with on those?
Probably the vast majority of the time were the 500-pound dumb bombs.
Okay.
We had, of course, we didn't go to North Vietnam.
Right.
So we were restricted primarily to the southern half of Laos,
uh-huh,
and the northern half of Vietnam. Primarily, that's because in the southern half, most of the time, that was Cameron Bay's responsibility, and the very far north was Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
The northern part of Laos was handled out of Thailand.
Okay.
So, I mean, we would run into people from the other bases once in a while, but we usually had our own little area of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I flew as often as I could possibly fly. I was probably in country at the most 250 days,
mm-hmm,
and I flew 229 missions, but I only flew about 40 the last 3 months I was there.
Oh, so you really front-end loaded those when you
first... I woke up.
Okay. Was there a particular incident that...
Absolutely was.
You? Do you want to tell me about that?
Well, Captain Gray and I had gone out on a mission. By now, we'd been there about 8 months, probably. And it was getting real close to the time I was going to go to Hawaii and meet my wife for R&R.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular mission, we were doing low-level, low-angle dive bombing. And we were down in a valley, and we were concentrating so hard because it was troops in contact, and we had good guys fighting off the bad guys.
Right.
And we didn't quite pay as much attention as we should, and we made a run in we were dropping napalm at the time.
Okay.
And we pulled off the target, and we both looked up, and we were looking straight at a mountain. And we were about to hit this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I uttered an oath, we both grabbed the stick and started pulling. He hit the afterburners, and we were just below the level of a stall. And, I mean, I thought, this is it.
Yeah.
I mean, I bought the big one, and the last thing I said is something God's going to make me pay for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of when I said, you know, I'd really like to kind of go home. And I'm going to slow down.
You weren't running after every mission then after
no.
that?
No. As a matter of fact, I was much more ready to assist a pilot in a pullout that if I thought he was too close to the ground, I said, hey, that's enough. I was very vocal in telling him, this is stupid, don't do this.
Uh-huh. Were you still with Captain Gray?
No, he, unfortunately, he, in November, or October, November, along in there, his wife was pregnant while he was over there, and she had a child that was born with hydroencephalitis.
Okay.
And he had gone home and came back and was just kind of devastated, and he came to me and said, what do I do? And I said, you go home. I mean, she needs you a whole lot worse than you need to be here. You've done what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get credit for a full tour. If you've been there more than 181 days, go home. So he went home.
Did he feel concerned about leaving you there?
He felt guilty.
Mm-hmm. And you told him don't?
I told him, go home. That's where you belong. I said, you know, if it were me, I'd go home.
Yeah. And he listened to you?
He did. He went home. And, we've been friends ever since.
And you feel now you absolutely did the right thing.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So the pilots that you were talking to and being more vocal with later on, were you working with one or two guys? Or what?
No, I had been there long enough that they started sticking me with the new guys.
I see.
And they also stuck me a lot with the people from wing headquarters or the command post who didn't fly very often
uh-huh.
and needed an experienced person along to make sure they didn't hurt themselves.
Uh-huh. And why were they flying at all?
Well, they had to.
In order?
they had flying requirements.
Okay.
They had to know, you know, if they were going to be in charge of the guys fighting the war, they had to know what was going on in the war.
Okay. And so you were supposed to take care of them?
Yeah, you know, look out for them.
Uh-huh. And you, after this incident where you were looking at the mountain, basically, you just decided that you had to say when things were not right and you weren't going to...
That's right. I was much more vigilant, I can assure you.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the time period before that incident when you were running to every mission you could get. What was really motivating that?
It filled the time very well.
Okay.
And remember, in 250 days, I flew 229 times. There were many days that you didn't fly at all, either from weather or you weren't on the schedule or whatever. So there were days that I flew two or three times.
Right.
But in the down times, I mean, it was boring. I mean, you could only drink so much.
Right.
And the other jobs I had that, you know, I would take care of them, and they would just kind of get them out of the way. And now what do I do? So, you know, you actually wind up probably getting in trouble more than you should just because you don't have anything to do.
Yeah, just because there's nothing productive for you to be up to.
I mean, I went over to help the scheduler, and I would go over. We had another little duty where we were we were assigned to the what they call the duty desk, where you kept track of the takeoffs and landings and make sure everybody got off on time, that the air crews were where they were supposed to be, and you logged them back in, made sure everybody got back.
Mm-hmm.
That was maybe once or twice a week.
But you didn't like sitting around doing nothing.
I did not. I made jobs.
Were there other guys like you who just couldn't bear to kind of sit around and do nothing? Or were you pretty much alone with that?
There were other people who were... It was usually more people who wanted to make a name for themselves because they wanted to make a career out of it.
I see. And so they needed as many missions.
Yeah, they wanted to fly and they wanted to be... to fly with the important people and go on the important missions. I mean, I'm going to be truthful with you. The entire year that I was there, the missions that we flew, I probably flew at least five that were worth flying.
What was the difference? Can you explain the difference?
I mean, they used to send us out to blow down trees to make a landing zone for helicopters.
Using what weapons?
That same dumb bomb with an extended fuse that made it go off above the ground.
Okay, right. And
LZ prep, they call it, landing zone preparation.
Right, and this was just stupid to you? I mean,
it was. Think about how much that cost.
Mm-hmm.
The training of the people that went into it, the machinery that they're using for something they're going to use for a few days and then abandon it.
Did you also feel that you were taking unnecessary risks with that kind of? I mean,
No, we were.
Okay.
I mean, we used to go out and you know, the forward air controller, when we got done bombing, would say, "Well, I think you've got 200 suspected sniper locations." Trees.
That was what a tree was called?
Yeah. I mean, you had to have bomb damage assessment.
Right, exactly. So they had to quantify it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Suspected, what was that, suspected sniper location?
Yeah.
What did you, like, discern about how the military effort was functioning from that kind of...
Well, when you first go, of course, you're so wrapped up in being you and trying not to die and all of that stuff. You don't worry about it too much. But after you've been there for a while, you realize that a lot of what you're doing is wasted. I mean, you're not accomplishing anything. You're not defeating an enemy. You know, it was a great comfort to even go out once in a while on a troops in contact when you were actually trying to help someone. Or a search and rescue mission when someone had been shot down and you're trying to get them out just because you felt like finally you're doing something.
Yeah, and the longer you're there, the meaningful missions...
They're very few and far between.
And they mean more.
Sure.
Yeah. What other kinds of missions didn't feel so meaningful to you? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Well, they used to send us up on the trails and coming out of Laos, out from North Vietnam, out of Laos at night. From 25 or 30,000 feet, and a radar guidance would put us on a heading and tell us what altitude and airspeed to fly and tell us when to pick our bombs. And we were supposed to be bombing the trail or trucks. I mean, from 25,000 feet, come on.
You had no idea what you were actually dropping bombs on.
Never saw it. Never couldn't even see them hit. It probably had a cloud cover underneath it.
Right. That's the altitude of a standard commercial.
Yeah.
Aircraft cruising at 25,000 feet.
I mean, just a total waste.
Did that disconnect between you and the target bother you? I mean...
Well, I didn't want to know, generally.
Okay, but...
I mean, I saw one person one time that I thought we might have killed,
uh-huh.
And I still remember it. And the rest of the time, it was something. I mean, I'm totally... glad that I saw little to nothing of the destruction that we must have caused.
Mm-hmm. Did you think about that too?
Not until later, because we didn't see it.
Okay, but while you were there, you really didn't think that much about it.
No, that was, I mean, it was an enemy, and if we got somebody, okay. If we didn't, well, so be it.
We'll get them next time, kind of thing. What about this one mission where you think you might have seen someone that was hurt or killed?
Well, it would happen to be another troops in contact. They were fighting off the enemy, and I actually saw a guy with a hat in a tree shooting at me and pointed him out, and we came back around and napalmed the heck out of the tree. So
that was over for him.
I would assume so.
Mm-hmm. But you remember that very clearly?
Oh, yes.
How do you feel when you remember it?
That particular time when we did it, he was trying to kill me.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so it was the right thing to do.
Sure.
Do you feel
now, looking back, you know, they weren't doing anything more than trying to do their jobs. They didn't want to die any more than I wanted to die.
So it's less clear now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The missions that you actually felt were important, you said there were just a handful of them. What made them important?
Well, two of the most memorable times that I flew were search and rescue missions when another F-4 had been shot down somewhere in Laos and surrounded by bad guys, and we had to go get them out.
Mm-hmm.
Our job was to lay down enough ordnance to cause the enemy to stop firing at the helicopters that were going to go in and pick them up.
Okay.
And when we were able to do that, that was, I mean, first of all, it gave you the sense that no matter what, they're going to try to get you out if you go down.
Yes.
I mean, to see the number of people and aircraft that would go on something like that, I mean literally hundreds.
To get one person out. Mm-hmm. And that happened to you a couple times that you were involved in that kind of effort?
Three times that I know of. Two of them very, very memorable.
Okay. Would one of those have involved Captain Rash?
Yes.
Okay. Was he able to get out?
Rash was, yes.
Okay. So you were flying basically cover for the helicopters that were going to insert?
Actually, the close cover was flown by a little propeller-driven job called an A-1 SPAD.
Okay, yeah.
And they went down and shot the guys who were shooting rifles. Our job was to get the big guns, the anti-aircraft guns that were shooting at the low-flying airplane.
Okay. And you would get information about the locations of those guns from the FACs?
From the forward air controllers, the FACs.
Okay.
And they used white phosphorus rockets to fire, and they would, I mean, you know, if it didn't hit exactly there, they'd say hit 100 meters north of my smoke or south of my smoke, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go down, and sometimes we would see something and sometimes not, but the forward air controller, being much lower and slower, could see what was happening and could tell when the firing stopped.
Can you tell me anything about the incident with Captain Rash? What happened that? Was it at night?
Well, he was shut down.
Okay. And he was
late in the afternoon.
Okay. And he was over Laos when that happened?
Yes, it was up in northern Laos in a place called Barrow Road. And it was one of those truly dumb things to do on his part. He was actually out of a base in Thailand. And he was what they called a fastback. He went up in North Vietnam where the light aircraft couldn't go and patrolled the trails looking for targets.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, we weren't going into North Vietnam much, but he would go into the edge of North Vietnam, or the wolf packs, they were called, would go in and come back down the trails looking for trucks coming out of North Vietnam or people.
And if he saw a target?
He would call in ordnance on them.
Okay.
So that was their job. Well, he had taken out another new guy who was a backseater on his first ride as a Wolfpack.
Okay.
And was going to give him an orientation. And being the stupid fighter pilots that we all were, okay, he decided he would go down low through the pass and show him the guns shooting at him. Well, they got him. And the backseater was killed. Dennis Pugh.
P-U-G-H?
P-U-G-H.
And he was killed in the aircraft?
In the ejection.
Oh, in the ejection? Uh-huh.
Well, they didn't get him back, so, you know, I don't know exactly, but, right. I mean, Rash said that he thought he was killed during the ejection.
Okay.
Rash managed to get his nose back up and got slightly back into Laos and then ejected. And he was on the ground for 30-some-odd hours. And he was shot down late one afternoon, and we didn't go up until the next day, but we did manage to suppress the fire enough that they got him out while we were there. But, I mean, when I say we, I mean a great number of airplanes.
Like, can you estimate again how many?
Oh, probably at any given time, 10 of the A1E SPADs down low, probably 3 or 4 of the rescue helicopters, and probably 20 or 30 fighter jets up above.
Do you know much about his experience while he was on the ground and what happened?
I can read about it. It's readily available on the internet. He managed to just hide and was actually directing some of the aircraft where they were being shot at.
So he had radio.
Yeah, he had we all carried a little handheld radio.
Okay, and his was still functional once he
was
on the ground. What unit was he with, do you know?
I can't remember what the 427th TAC Fighter Squadron, I believe it was, the Wolf Packs.
Okay, and he was based out of Thailand, you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was front seater.
Okay. There were other missions that you flew that were also in cover for search and rescue?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about either of those other missions?
They're not as memorable as that one. They were in South Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
One I remember, I can't remember the fellow's name. We did manage to get him out, but, I mean, I think they lost 5 aircraft during the rescue effort. We almost lost one. We were a 2-ship flight, and our squadron commander was in the other airplane, and he took a round through the fuel line and was pulling off the target. We saw it. When we saw it, it was Captain Gray and I. And I mean, I started telling him that, you know, he's trailing smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And we called him and told him that you're trailing smoke. And he said, well, he didn't have any light, so it looked like everything was okay. And we pulled up closer. And we said, well, it's not a fire. It looked like it's fuel. And, I mean, it was just coming out of every hole on the airplane.
Wow.
So we asked him to check his fuel, and he could tell that it was going down very fast, and he got a little concerned.
I bet.
And started asking us to vector him back to the nearest base. So I got all the heading and information and so forth and started calling people and telling them, you know, mayday, mayday, we got one that's hit.
Mm-hmm.
And we got him back to a base called Chu Lai, which was a Marine base, and got them on final, and we followed them down as low as we could go. We were afraid that they were going to run out of fuel and flame out. I mean, it was not that the airplane was burning or not flying. It was just they were going to run out of fuel.
And be unable to execute a safe landing.
That's right. And he actually landed, and the engines flamed out at the far end of the runway.
Wow. That was close. When you say vector him in, can you explain to someone who wouldn't understand that language what that means?
Well, vectoring means simply getting him a heading and going back the correct direction and then started giving him closer directions on how to get to the Air Force base that he was going to. We had, if you recall, I mentioned the TACAN air navigation, which is a radio system.
Mm-hmm.
But often when you get down low, you lose lock because it's line of sight. And he had gotten down low, and he was semi-panicked, very concerned. I don't know if panic's the right word, but he was not thinking as clearly as he should because he was worrying about the airplane and worrying about his backseater and worrying about himself.
Right.
So we had to get him lined up on final and make sure that he was on pretty much the glide slope, and we could see the base. We were up above him and just kind of gave him headings to get him in close enough to see the base to land.
Which gave him one less thing that he had to
advantage.
Right.
That's right.
Giving him the information. And
make sure that all of his landing gear came down. He didn't have any hung bombs and that sort of thing.
Right. And so he was safe. And what about his backseater?
They were fine.
They were both fine.
That was their last flight, it was their scheduled last flight in Vietnam.
Oh, really?
And they gave him a choice that they could wait and have their airplane repaired and bring it home, or they could catch a ride. And they said, nope, we'll catch a ride.
Yeah, thanks, Roddy. Yeah,
thanks, but no thanks.
I think I might have done the same thing.
As a matter of fact, that particular person that was flying that plane was our squadron commander and later became a major general.
Really? Would you say his last name? Do you know?
Burns. Ken Burns.
Okay. That was his last flight as scheduled, and so he was very short time, as you get. Okay. Were you observing people who were short timing, and can you comment on that?
It's not like the horror stories you hear.
Okay.
I mean, we made jokes about it.
Yeah.
You had a 100-day calendar, and you marked off each day of the last 100 days you were there. We called it your short calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And the blacker it got, the closer you were to getting home, you know. And we used to kid people, and they'd say something, you know, I got 98 days. And I said, man, I'm so short, if I fart, I'll kick dust on your boots. I'm so short, I don't even have time for long conversation. I got fewer days left than you got months.
And so it was kind of a black humor sort of thing.
That's right.
You guys you'd play with it and play with each other around it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And to make a big deal out of your last flight, you know, they'd send the fire trucks out and shoot water all over it and pour champagne on you.
And celebrate the fact that you were getting out of there.
That's right.
Yeah. Ryan, can we change gears for just a second? I want to ask you about mission constraints. You've alluded to this a couple of times about the fact that there were politically imposed no-go areas, and North Vietnam was, at the time you were there, one of those areas. Can you talk about how that felt to be actually a flyer and know that you couldn't actually go to the enemy's home turf?
Well, it was very disconcerting that we couldn't take the fight to them. We had to wait until the trucks came down or the enemies were in contact. It was totally defensive. There was no offense or very little offense involved. We were just kind of in a holding pattern. At the time, we still, quote, end quote, had no troops in Laos. Well, we went over to help get them out all the time.
Right, so you knew that was...
We knew they were there.
A cover.
You know, they called them long-range reconnaissance patrol, LRPs.
Yes.
They went over, and their job was to watch the trails and see the trucks come down, that sort of thing.
Right.
So, and once in a while, we'd have to go over and fly close air support to get them out of there.
Yes.
So we knew they were there. And truthfully, we weren't bombing Laos then.
We weren't politically, it wasn't known in
the right.
public. Right. Okay. And what about North Vietnam? Did you feel that you guys ought to have been able to...
If we were going to fight a war,
mm-hmm.
why did we have to fight it on our own territory and not on enemy territory? We used to get so aggravated. We would be sent up to the passes coming out of North Vietnam, and we would go down very low and mine the pass exit coming out of North Vietnam. We weren't allowed to go into Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have to go down and get in the weeds where we knew there were guns shooting at us and lay these stupid mines that all they had to do was run a bulldozer through there, and it set them all off.
So these are just surface-lying mines.
Right. And, I mean, really dumb things. And, I mean, that was a very dangerous mission.
Yes, because those passes were heavily guarded.
Uh-huh. And it's not like we did any good. So if we ever got the chance that we were bombing anywhere near North Vietnam, we used to do things like save two bombs and drive right up to the border and pull the nose up and just loft those two bombs as far into North Vietnam as we could throw them.
Did you really? Uh-huh. And what kind of feeling did that give you?
Like maybe we were doing a little something.
Okay, you hadn't, you know, violated the rules.
We hadn't gone into North Vietnam.
Right. Did you feel like you were accomplishing a little something on the side that that would help?
We were getting away with something.
Okay. And maybe helping guys on the ground.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully we hit something.
Yeah.
Or at least we let them know we're there.
What was your opinion of President Nixon? Was it changing at this point?
Oh, I had very low opinion of him. By the time he resigned, I was so sick and tired of that man.
Yeah. And this is all pre-Watergate and anything to do with his domestic problems. But while you were actually...
While I was in Vietnam,
uh-huh.
I mean, we held him and Robert McNamara responsible for the wasted effort. I mean, we didn't talk about it a great deal, but
right.
we all knew.
Right.
You know, how can you win a war waiting for them to attack you?
Mm-hmm. Did you have feelings about Henry Kissinger?
I felt like he was one of the few good guys.
Okay, why was that?
Because he was at least there in Paris trying to get us out of this mess.
Okay, and did you think that that was an honest negotiating effort?
I thought that he was probably being told to do whatever it took to get us out. I thought he was in a very untenable position
mm-hmm.
that I don't know that he really believed in what he was doing or felt that the North Vietnamese were negotiating as fairly as he was, but that was not his job. His job was to get us out.
Right. So you were drawing a distinction at that point anyway between Nixon and Kissinger and what they were.
Oh, yes.
Okay, and what was it about Nixon that made you think that he was not he wasn't playing the role that you had felt he would when you voted for him?
Well, while I was in Vietnam was when the wind down began, And while I didn't disagree that we needed to get out of there if we weren't going to go over there to win the war, I thought there was never an honest effort made to win the war. I felt like that the restrictions that were put on, we can't bomb North Vietnam, we can't do this, we can't do that, we have to have someone that clears us on every single target. Every target is sent from Saigon, from the generals.
Right.
Early in the war, they used to go, what they call, look for targets of opportunity. They just go look for something to bomb.
Right.
But Lord, we couldn't do that.
You mean the pilots had
permission? Yeah.
Right.
We couldn't do that. If we saw a truck, we'd have to get permission to bomb it.
And how long would something like that, did you make calls like that?
Very rarely, because it would take too long.
I was going to ask you, how
long? It'd be long gone before we were allowed to do it. We had to have a forward air controller to mark every single target.
So you could never just kind of let go with something if you knew there was troop concentration or something like that?
We were either under positive radar control, being told when to drop the bomb, or had a forward air controller marking the target saying hit right there.
Okay, positive control. Can you explain that? How did that work, actually?
Well, if it was airborne control,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they were vectoring us, giving us altitudes, telling us the airspeed to fly, and pickle your bombs now, without us ever seeing anything. We were just kind of a machine.
You're just sort of the remote control?
Yeah. I mean, they could have done that with a...
With a drone?
With a drone.
Uh-huh. Why do you think they didn't? I mean, that technology was coming.
I don't think they had the...
Not quite.
The
but...
numbers mm-hmm. of... the vehicles that they needed. And back then, we didn't have the technology. You still had to have someone to be able to see what it is that you're about to try to bomb.
Right. What about smart bombs? Those were just coming online, too. Did you have any feeling about whether those should have been used in Vietnam?
I think that, well, they were used.
Okay.
But they were very limited supply.
Yeah.
They came out somewhere around 67. First of all, the first bombs, first several versions of them, were strictly visual. I mean, you could only use them if you could see the target. And a lot of times the weather was very bad over there,
mm-hmm.
either from clouds or haze or smoke or what have you. So they were a little limited. But when they were used, they were extremely effective.
And what kinds of targets were they actually deployed against?
Usually hard targets, railroad tracks, railroad bridges, steel mills.
Anti-aircraft emplacements at all?
No, not so much that. They had a different airplane called the Wild Weasel they used for that had a guided bomb.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think you mentioned in your questionnaire that you seem to think that cost was also a factor in terms of the deployment of those smart bombs and how many were used.
Well, I think cost to some extent, but I don't think they were available.
Mm-hmm. There weren't that many of them.
They just didn't have them. Mm-hmm. And really all it was a kit they added onto a dumb bomb. It wasn't like a whole new bomb created.
Okay.
It was a kit that was added on that gave a guidance.
Did you guys at Phucat ever have those?
No.
Okay.
We had them in Germany when I got there.
Which was later after
right.
FU. Okay.
They had a few of them in Thailand.
And what targets were they choosing to use in Northern Laos, do you know?
Well, they were not used, I don't think, in Laos.
Okay, where
they were used in Vietnam
uh-huh.
to some extent. They were used in the passes coming out of North Vietnam
okay.
to primarily to try to knock out the anti-aircraft sites that were there.
Okay.
So you could go down and do your mining and look for trucks and so forth and so on. But there were just not that many over there.
If you had to say what weapons you had used most often on the missions that you were on, primarily when you first were over there, the first several months you were over there, what were the most popular weapons that you used?
Well, it was almost
all 500 pounds?
500 pound dumb bombs.
Okay, and napalm?
We did use napalm.
Okay, how was the napalm configured? What was that weapon actually like?
Well, it was like almost like a fuel tank.
Okay.
It had very small fins on the back of it.
Uh-huh.
It was designed to tumble when it came off the aircraft. It was large.
Yeah.
It was in physical size much larger than a than a 500-pound bomb. I don't remember the exact size. It wasn't nearly as heavy.
Almost like a propane tank?
Yeah, and it was jellied gasoline.
Yeah.
And, it would burn anything. It burned it at very intense heat.
Right.
You had to... We used those against things like... if you had a truck, you could certainly use it against that. You could use it against troops, but only if you were a pretty good distance away from the friendlies. You have to remember that not only did it burn, but it sucked all the air out of the area.
Okay.
I mean, it could kill you just from sucking all the air out of you.
Consuming all the oxygen.
Right.
By the fast burn.
So you had to be very careful. So we didn't use it that much.
Uh-huh. What is a CBU?
That is a cluster bomb unit, and all it is a canister that holds hundreds of small bomblets.
Mm-hmm.
It's used for a large target, generally either troops, or it's very effective against trucks because it doesn't require the accuracy of a single bomb.
Okay, you don't have to hit them directly.
Right, it's an area saturation type thing rather than a pinpoint type munition.
Uh-huh. And those were used... With some frequency too?
Yeah, we use those a lot against the anti-aircraft guns because you didn't have to hit exactly on top of them.
Okay. Uh-huh.
We use them against non-hardened targets like trucks. We used it some against troops, but not too much because of the inherent inaccuracy.
Right.
Because they spread out a very great deal. Because all it was a canister that dropped off the airplane, opened up, and all these little bomblets fell out.
Did you ever see one of these taken apart?
Yeah.
Okay. How big were the bomblets inside?
Oh, small. Maybe 4, 5, 6 inches at the outside.
Like maybe the size of a fist or a grenade or something?
Size of a baseball or softball. No, smaller than softball.
Okay.
Baseball size.
And were those in effect, shrapnel?
They were designed. They were the way they were designed, they were round, like a baseball, but they had contoured pieces across them that were designed to be shrapnel.
Okay. Okay.
And we also carried the same dumb bombs with what, as I mentioned before, the extended fuses.
Right.
They were about 3 feet long, and those were designed to, the fuse would cause the bomb to go off above ground rather than bury into the ground before it went off or blow up something on the ground. Those were anti-personnel devices.
Okay. And they were supposed to detonate about how far off the ground was ideal?
3 feet.
And just blow to the sides?
Yeah.
Okay. Would those leave a crater? Those
not nearly like the hard bombs would, not
okay.
like the dumb bombs would.
Okay.
They were still just 500-pound bombs, but they had this extended fuse on.
Mm-hmm. You said that was about 3 feet long?
Uh-huh.
Wow. Were there special units or men with particular training who actually loaded the weapons onto your plane?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What were those units called?
Well, they were weapons loaders.
Okay.
I mean, a real technical name.
Okay.
They drove a little thing called a jammer that carried bombs. And it was like a very low-to-the-ground forklift. This thing had prongs that stuck out on the front.
Yeah.
It actually had a cradle to pick up the munition, take it under the airplane, and lift it up. And then there was another guy who turned the wrench and locked it in. These guys were the hot rodders. They loved that job.
Yeah,
driving this little cart.
And they had to act fast, right?
Oh yeah, they would go like crazy.
Because you guys would be scrambled to a mission potentially.
They had to reload as soon as we got back.
Okay. And so the aircraft would sit loaded.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And did they have to switch out munitions different times, like if you had to go on a mission that required napalm, did they?
No, what they did is they had four aircraft at a time sitting alert.
Okay.
Two hard munitions, two soft munitions.
Okay.
The hard munitions would be just the dumb bombs.
Right.
Soft munitions would be half napalm and half CBUs.
Okay. I see. So the aircraft are sitting there ready for
you.
Yeah,
and they would scramble you based on what their need was.
Okay. To an aircraft that had a particular
right. No,
munition.
You were assigned to an aircraft.
Okay.
But they scrambled the crews.
Oh, the crews. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay, so that's why sometimes you would be called out and sometimes
right.
not.
Right, there would be eight guys on alert at a time, four airplanes, two with soft, two with hard.
Got it, okay.
All right. And Sabre.
And Sabre, up to the ditch.
Yeah.
But no further. Okay. Ronnie, let's take a break for a minute.
Okay.
This is Dr. Laura Coffins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Captain Ronnie Lee Houston of the United States Air Force. Today's date is the 5th of February, 2004. I'm in the interview room, Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech. And Captain Houston is in the Woodlands, Texas again. How are you, sir?
I'm well.
Very good. I wonder if you can clarify for me just a couple of points. First of all, I want to make sure that I'm correct in thinking you were continuously based at Phu Cát. You did not move to another base at any time. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Sir, I want to ask you about whether you attended or had an opportunity to attend any USO shows.
Sure. We had at least one, if not two.
Okay.
Certainly we had one that was the Miss America. That seemed to always come.
Uh-huh. Do you remember any details about that?
I remember them arriving. I remember the show. I remember the aircraft flyover during the show. I remember exactly where it was held.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to recall. There were some Hollywood stars, too, but I don't really remember them.
Was Bob Hope there?
No.
Okay. The Miss America shows, would this have actually been at Phu Cát?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Held in the open.
In the open?
Yes.
Who generally attended? Were they
everybody.
People? Or people coming in from the field, or do you know?
No. There were some from the field. It's primarily the people at the base.
Mm-hmm.
There's more Air Force than anything else.
What was the mood? Can you describe it?
Oh, it was very... it was a fun time, and everyone was happy to see them there and had good seating. The weather, of course, was very warm, and no one seemed to mind.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a fun time.
Did you attend as part of the unit, or did you just kind of float in by
yourself?
Oh, no.
We went by ourselves.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Of course, I went with friends, but...
Sure. How long was the performance? Do you have any idea?
I'm going to say it was somewhere around an hour and a half to a couple of hours.
What kinds of stuff did they do?
A lot of singing, a lot of dancing. They had a band.
Uh-huh.
That type of thing.
Yeah.
It seems that they had some comedian also, but it's been so long.
Sure. Can you talk about how you felt having... civilians come from the States who didn't have to be there. Did you value what they were doing?
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Number one, remember, we had no American women stationed at Phu Cát.
Yes, sir.
So it was a pleasure just to see American women.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to take time to come, I mean, I don't think most people would have been there given a choice, and they came by choice.
Right. They were civilians in a war zone. I mean,
sure.
Yeah, I think it's quite admirable that people took the risks they took. Sir, I want to ask you a little bit also about any R&R breaks that you had during your tour.
Well, I had two official R&Rs and a couple of unofficial.
Okay.
The two official was the North. Everyone in Vietnam had a chance for a 1 week R&R, given a choice of several different places, among which were Bangkok, Australia, and Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Being married at the time, I, of course, selected Hawaii, and I met my wife there. That was later in my tour.
Okay.
And I did that on purpose, so I'd be getting closer to time to go home.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Would have been in October of 1970, and I met my wife there.
Okay.
She came a little bit early and stayed a little bit longer.
Uh-huh.
And we also had a sort of a, we called it a boondoggle trip, that there was a regularly scheduled once per week C-47 that transited bringing supplies, from Hong Kong.
Uh-huh.
And they usually travel back fairly empty. And we were allowed to put our names on a list and try to get on the plane going to Hong Kong. And, of course, you came back trying to sit around and make room despite all of the washers and dryers and all of the other stuff that they were bringing in. But
right.
I got to do that also. That was about a 3-day trip.
Do you know about when you were over there?
That would have been in, I'm going to say about November, because it was getting close to the end of my tour.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of Hong Kong?
Oh, it was nothing but fun. It was one of those places where you go expecting people trying to take your money, and they do so, although it was very inexpensive at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The dollar was still fairly strong, and we were met at the airplane by a local tailor with a Volkswagen van to give us a ride to the hotel. So we knew up front that, you know, here's the guy that wants to sell us all our clothing.
Sure.
And he took us out to dinner that night. He had reservations made for us at a hotel, and of course it happened to be, fortunately, right across the street from his place of business.
Mm-hmm.
And our rooms weren't quite ready, so why don't we come over and have a drink first?
Mm-hmm.
Just fortuitous.
As it were. Uh-huh.
Right.
And,
I mean, it was an enjoyable time.
Did you order up some suits of clothing?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Uh-huh.
I got, I think I ordered 2 suits, and I also got a new uniform, a pair of boots, and a pair of shoes.
And were you, this is November, and you had less than 2 months, I think, or just about
right.
2 months left. And were you doing this in anticipation of getting out of Vietnam and getting, you know, a different...
Well, somewhat, but
okay.
I mean, that was the things you did when you went to Hong Kong, where you ate well, you dressed well, and you bought your stereo gear.
Did you get any sound equipment?
Oh, of course.
Uh-huh. What did
Full
you
load.
Really? What kind of stuff did you buy?
Oh, back then it was reel-to-reel tape decks,
uh-huh.
and of course the amplifier and the speakers and so forth and so on, all of the attachments to put them together.
And were you primarily interested in listening to music, or were you...
Music.
Okay. Uh-huh. What kind of music do you listen to?
Oh, it was in the old rock and roll days.
Sure. Uh-huh. Were you kind of a rock guy? What they now call classic rock?
Yeah, that's exactly... I hear all those songs all the time on
uh-huh.
classic rock stations.
Yeah. You said there were an unofficial leave or two in there. What do you mean by that?
Well, we had a program that weekly, and there were two fighter squadrons stationed at Phuket.
Yes, sir.
Weekly, one squadron, and then the following week, the other squadron, went to the Philippines to take missiles that were getting past their useful life.
Mm-hmm.
And we would take the load of missiles, and they would have the warheads removed, of course. But we got to go to the Philippines and do live fire over the Philippine Sea. And they were going to get rid of the missiles anyway, so they figured that was a good chance for us to practice.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about a 3-day trip.
How many times did you do that, sir?
That I did once.
Uh-huh.
And I was very fortunate to get to go, because, as I say, for our whole squadron would have only been 26 trips the whole year.
Right.
And then... sort of because I was a friend of the scheduler,
mm-hmm.
we also took aircraft to Taiwan for what they called inspect and repair as necessary, which was IRAN,
mm-hmm.
we called it. And you delivered aircraft over there, and they sort of went through it and overhauled it and then sent it back, you know, making sure that the wings weren't going to fall off and bringing everything up to standard and so
mm-hmm.
forth. And as luck would have it, there was an aircraft there that was ready to be returned, but they wanted us to take it to Japan for some testing on a potting compound for electrical connections that they were having trouble with breaking down in the heat and humidity in Vietnam.
Okay.
So we delivered an aircraft to Taiwan, spent the night, and then went to Japan and wound up spending about 4 days there.
What base did you fly into at Japan?
Yokota Air Base.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe your time there? You spent a couple, 3 days there?
I think I spent 3 or 4 days. That was also in November. It was cold.
Okay.
Particularly
uh-huh.
kind of having left Vietnam.
Right.
And we spent a lot of time at the officers' club. The fellow I was with seemed to be more interested in resting and doing nothing. I sort of searched around and found someone I knew, and he at least took me into Tokyo for a little while
mm-hmm.
and out to eat. But, I mean, we didn't do much. And it was, you know, it was pretty much because the fellow I was with just didn't want to do anything.
Was he, would you say, exhausted or antisocial or what?
I think, if I recall, he had been there before and didn't need to do all the things I needed to do.
Did you feel a little bit like you didn't get to do the things you wanted to?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What was your impression of Tokyo, though? You did go down.
Big and it smelled. And they drive on the wrong side of the road.
Yes,
I was a little intimidated because, you know, first of all, I came from a small town, and secondly, I'd been off in a war zone for 10 months. So having that kind of freedom to come and go, it was a little scary.
What were you able to do? Did you go shopping or?
I did a little shopping. I also went out to eat at a little sushi place. And I visited a couple of friends that were there, and we did a lot of shopping. Also, they had the Pacific Exchange, which is the base exchange for the whole Pacific area, where they ship things out of. So it was like, the candy store.
Did you ever have a chance to go back to Japan?
No, never did. I passed through there when I was coming home from Vietnam and got gas, and that was it.
Okay. Is it somewhere you'd yet like to return to?
Not really.
Okay. Sir, I want to ask you a little bit about the earlier parts of your tour, much of which we talked about last time. But I'm interested in your general assessments of the enemy weaponry that you faced and that that you confronted. Can you talk about the anti-aircraft equipment that you were facing?
Well, primarily, when I was there, since we were not bombing into North Vietnam, we spent probably 60 or 70% of the time in South Vietnam, the rest of the time, at least at the beginning, in Laos. And most of it was either small arms, which is one-man carried rifle type things, but they also, as we got closer up to the DMZ and into northern part of Laos, had radar-guided light anti-aircraft, 57 millimeter, and you really couldn't see that much. You could see some black puffs, I guess you would say, but you would see it more at night because they used tracers. And the 37 and the 57, you could tell the difference. 37 is much faster, and it looked almost like someone's firing at you with a light machine gun is what it really looked like.
Yeah.
But we never faced any surface-to-air missiles other than they tracked us once in a while.
Do you remember any of those incidents when you were actually, I gather the terminology is locked onto? Can you describe how... first of all, what did that look like in the control panel in front of you?
Well, we had what was called a RAW, R-H-A-W, radar homing and warming scope.
Okay.
And it was nothing more than an LED light that would indicate the bearing to the radar that was tracking you.
Mm-hmm.
It had a series of indicators. One was just simply a tracking mode where they're just sweeping the general area. One was a lock-on mode where they painted just you, and then you, if it was a surface-to-air missile, they also had a firing mode which was much more intense. And what we saw primarily were just the tracking mode and lock-on from small AAA.
Mm-hmm.
When they came on, and primarily at night again, because in the daytime you really couldn't see them that well. At night you could see them. You could see where the fire was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And being young, foolish, and bulletproof and immortal, I mean, we actually went up and what we call trolled for them. I mean, we tried to get them to track us because once we could figure out where they were, we could follow the beam to get on a heading, and then as we got closer to them and they began to fire, we could actually see where they were firing from, and then it was like, I gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we actually did... I mean, we call it chicken races. I mean, if we had the proper ordnance, and even if it wasn't the proper ordnance, or whatever ordnance we had, I mean, we would actually literally go hunt for them, troll for them when we got them to come up. I mean, we would track down the beam looking for them and try to blow them up.
And was there ever a time when you were successful doing that, do you think?
Well, we shut them up.
You hit them?
Yeah. Well, I would say so. Either that or we scared them into stopping the fire.
Uh-huh. Okay. How did it feel when you would get one of those the indication that you had been locked onto?
Actually, it was sort of an adrenaline rush.
Okay.
I mean, it was somewhat exhilarating.
Uh-huh.
We were foolish enough to think that we were going to always get them before they got us.
And you knew that wasn't really true, though, in some part of your mind, though, didn't you, sir?
You know, it wasn't something you considered.
Really?
I never really thought I was going to get hit. Even the couple of times we came back with holes in the aircraft, we were probably more surprised than anything else.
Is that right? Tell me about one of those times when you found holes in the aircraft. Did you find that on inspection, or did the maintenance guys find it? Or
no, we pulled into the refueling pit and uh-huh. popped the canopies and shut the engine down, and the crew chief was out there to refuel us, yelling at us, "What have you done to my airplane?"
Uh-huh.
And we went back and looked, and in the vertical stabilizer, pardon
yeah.
me,
uh-huh.
was a hole probably, I don't know, 18 inches, 2 feet.
Really?
Took a big hunk out of it.
Wow. Yeah, did that affect performance as you were flying?
No.
That you noticed?
Never noticed it.
Huh.
Never noticed it. Didn't know it till we got back.
What, did you have a theory about what weapon had done that?
Probably range? A 37 millimeter. If it had been a 57, it probably would knock the whole tail off.
Wow.
But, we came back a couple of times with small arms from, 7.62 millimeter, but that's small potatoes.
Yeah, and not, would that be insufficient usually?
Yeah, that was nothing more than required a patch.
Sir, you talked about flying missions over Laos. Can you characterize the missions in general or break them out into the different types of missions you were flying over Laos?
Well, in Laos, most often when we went there was at night looking for trucks,
uh-huh.
which was sort of ineffectual because we didn't really have very good munitions to do so. But we would have gunships, or sometimes we had listening posts that were nothing more than long-range reconnaissance patrols out there that heard or saw trucks and call us in on them.
Mm-hmm.
And we really, short of setting one on fire, you never really knew whether you hit it or not. I mean, we would go out and bomb the heck out of them. It seemed like kind of a waste, to be truthful.
Right.
You couldn't see what you were doing.
Did you think the weapons that you were applying were greater than the targets that you were striking? Is that what you mean?
No, generally speaking, in order to get a truck, you need something that's pretty area-wide intensive,
okay.
like a CBU, cluster bomb unit.
Mm-hmm.
And too often we would have a hard bomb or an anti-personnel bomb or something like that that's more pinpoint than area-wide.
Sir, you also mentioned in the materials that you filled out for us that you did think you flew over North Vietnam on two different missions. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about those missions? When do you think that happened in your tour?
One of them that was intentional
mm-hmm.
was a B-52 strike in just above the DMZ. And we would go up through the DMZ to the border as we were supposed to be cover for them in case any MiGs came along, but we never saw them. But we would drive up just past the border and turn around and come back. And we carried a load of ordnance with us, and we made sure we dropped it before we got out of North Vietnam. But we really, I mean, it was kind of a waste. Now, the other time, we did go up into the passes on the far side of the passes in North Vietnam and come back through the passes to lay mines in those passes
right.
for trucks coming out of there.
Right.
That was normally a mission handled by the planes out of Thailand because it was kind of far for us.
Uh-huh.
But on at least once, if not two occasions, we did that.
On the day that you were tasked with that mining operation, do you know why you were called, your squadron?
Well, we were called because it was it was during the dry season, and there were the trucks and materials coming out of North Vietnam were building, and they couldn't get enough aircraft out of Thailand to do sufficient mining, so they called on us to do it also. And we were, it was not something we were that well trained at.
How much training had you had in dropping that kind of weapon?
We had a briefing prior to.
Okay.
On the parameters to drop it. I mean, there's not a great deal of difference other than those things you fly straight and level and, you know, drop them.
Mm-hmm. And what, where were you trying to lay them specifically? You mentioned passes.
These, that would have been what's called Banphanop Pass, Banphanop, which is southern part of North Vietnam, not too far above the DMZ. There's a pass through the mountains.
Mm-hmm. And your understanding was that that was being used as a throughway for resupply by the
North Vietnam? Oh, absolutely it was. It was, mm-hmm. It was not just my understanding. We knew it for a fact.
Okay. Based on what kinds of information?
Intelligence information. They had listing posts. They had other aircraft that laid sensors.
Acoustic sensors?
Acoustic sensors.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they knew where the activity was.
Okay. And as an officer who was flying in these kinds of missions, were you given briefings that gave you some sense of the intelligence information that the mission would be based
on? They would tell us during the intelligence portion of the briefing, not the mission briefing.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the mission briefing, we always went to what we called intel or intelligence office, and they told us what the target was, why, what we were looking for.
Okay.
And they gave us any information on known enemy activity in the area or guns or what have you. And that's when they would tell us that this is the activity that's going on and this is what we're targeting.
Now, at those intelligence briefings, would that be done by an intelligence officer assigned to your squadron?
No, they were assigned to the wing.
Okay. Uh-huh.
They would do both squadrons.
Okay. And, you know, these were obviously Air Force personnel, but from what branch, do you know?
Well, they were unrated. They weren't pilots or navigators. I guess they were just trained intelligence officers.
Okay. And so typically, for a mission, you would have these two different briefings, the intelligence and then the actual mission construction
briefing?
That's
correct. Okay. We went to the intel shop. Actually, we had three briefings.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Because we went to the intel shop and got the intel briefing. Immediately following that, we would get a weather briefing from a meteorologist.
Okay.
On weather, expected weather in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would go back to our squadron building, which they were very close to one another. And that's when we would discuss mission specifics.
Now, the weather information that you got, was it generally accurate?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty good at it. But remember, too, they had, I mean, there were literally hundreds of aircraft over there. So they had up-to-the-date visual information.
That's true.
I mean, yes, they could forecast, is it getting worse or is it getting better? But, I mean, you knew what the weather was because there was somebody there.
Somebody had just been there.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And so you were really getting more or less what we now call real-time information about the weather conditions?
The weather, at least, yes.
Uh-huh. And
we didn't get real-time information on how intense the activity going on was. It was probably 12 hours old.
Okay. Uh-huh. And can you describe a mission briefing? Would there be more than just the crews who were expecting to fly attending those?
No, that was just for them.
Okay. And how were they organized? Pretend you're going to give one for a minute. The person who would be giving these, actually.
Okay, they were normally on a mission, normally consisted of two aircraft, four air crew members.
Okay.
There was a flight lead who was the aircraft commander of the lead airplane.
Mm-hmm.
He was in charge of the mission. The wingman was another pilot, and he was there just to do what he was told by the flight lead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, periodically you would have four, but it was similar. You'd have flight lead, you'd have what was called element lead, which is the second two. But the flight lead was still in charge of the entire mission, so he was the one who gave the briefing. And at that time, he would discuss, first of all, what specific ordnance are you carrying. He would look at the target itself, and there was some discussion, but generally he would decide on the best means of entry and exit to the target area, from what direction, from what altitude, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We would also discuss if we were going to hit a tanker, then we had to discuss that, of course, where it was going to be and what the coordinates were and what the call sign was, and we went over the frequencies. We talked about the specific ordnance we were carrying and the requirements for either dive angle or airspeed or what restrictions we may have in that particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would discuss egress, where we would meet up after coming off the target and discuss a general route back.
Okay. Were you also apprised of other aircraft that were going to be in the area or not?
Usually there were no other aircraft other than the forward air controller.
Mm-hmm.
The things that would be different would be if it was a search and rescue mission or if it was troops in contact. If it were search and rescue or troops in contact, certainly we talked about who else was there, but that was a shifting thing.
Right.
So we had an airborne control command center, ABCCC, that sorted out all that information when we were airborne.
Okay.
They would tell us who is in the area and kind of try to give us an idea of where. They also had a radar that they could tell where the aircraft were. They would tell us who the on-scene commander is for troops in contact or search and rescue, whatever it was, if it was a big gaggle of aircraft there.
Uh-huh. And the on-scene commander, who would that typically be, or did it vary by the situation?
It wasn't a particular person. It was generally the higher-ranking person. And he was the one who was doing the tasking. He was the one who would decide. And it was not always just one person doing the deciding, but they would take the intelligence report. Let's say it was a search and rescue mission,
okay.
just to pick one.
Right.
He would be the person that would decide when we're going and how many airplanes we're taking, what are they to be loaded with. We call that tasking. And at what time we're going to try to pick him up. And he would be the coordinator of all these planes. So he would go in and loiter in the area, and then he would call in the various types of aircraft. He would call in the what we call the Sandies or the SPAD, which were the low-flying propeller-driven jobs, to try to get the guns in the area to stop firing.
Mm-hmm.
Once that happened, or if it didn't happen, then he would bring in heavier ordnance, such as us.
Okay.
And he was also attempting to spot exactly where the firing was coming from. He acted like a forward air controller, but he was much more involved than that.
Mm-hmm.
Then he would make the decision when the attempted pickup was to be made. And he would also tell the various aircraft where to go to hold until it's your time to come in. He kept track of who had what kind of ordnance. He kept track of who was where. Another airplane got shot down. He then became responsible for that. It was a very intense time.
Very, very much so. Sir, can I ask you about contingency plans that you might have had for missions, not necessarily search and rescue, but your other missions, in the event that one of the planes was disabled?
Well, we always tried to decide, first of all, in the area where we are, if things were perfect and you could take your airplane to somewhere to get out, where would you take the airplane before you eject?
Okay.
So, yes, that was a contingency plan. But before that, mm-hmm. one of the first things, decisions you had to make, and it was on person by person, we had a choice of whether the backseater was going to eject only himself or himself and the front seat. Then you had to make a conscious decision and turn a handle. If the back seat were going to eject both people, he had to physically turn this handle. And it would stay turned until he turned it back off.
Okay, that was an enabling device to allow both seats.
That's correct.
To go.
Uh-huh. Now, if the front seater ejected, you both go. But the back seater had to determine, do you want me to eject you also? And again, I was on a mission-by-mission basis.
Okay.
Just depending on who it was.
And did you have to sort that out with the front seater every time?
Yeah, we did that every time. Well, I mean, some guys, flew with on a regular basis, I knew what to do. But
sure.
Most of the time, you talked about it.
So, like with Jerry Gray, what was your standard operating, the two of you?
I always going to eject both of us.
Okay. And what determined your decisions around that choice?
Well, first of all, usually speaking, once you were out in combat, you didn't have time to make that decision. So
okay.
You need to make a one-time decision before you ever get to that point.
Yes, sir.
So his feeling was that if I needed to get out, then he needed to get out.
Uh-huh.
It was difficult to think of a time when only one of us would eject. Generally speaking, if all things were going equal, the front seater called the ejection, and he ejected both people.
Mm-hmm.
If the back seater ejected by himself or took the front seater with him, you were in dire straits.
Yes, sir. What were the situations that you were trained to go to the ejection option? Obviously, the aircraft being badly damaged, but was there a protocol that you had been trained into to know when it was time to take that decision?
Well, you had a manual that we carried with us. It was small in size, probably 6 or 8 inches by 5 inches by a good 2 to 3 inches thick, that had standard emergency procedures
okay.
in the very front part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 60-70% of those emergency procedures you memorized. You knew what to do.
Right.
If you had time, you could go back and go through the manual to make sure you've done them all. But there were certain things, such as a fire on board, that if you were by yourself, you had to make the decision, is it bad enough that I'm going to jump out? Some things, I mean, dual engine lost, I mean, that was pretty simple. Eject.
Right.
You know, that type thing. But most of them, you knew what to do. And you knew when the airplane was no longer capable of flying because it would be uncontrollable.
You wouldn't see it respond.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, you're trying to pull the nose up and it's not going, or you're trying to turn right and it's not going.
Mm-hmm. How much confidence would you say that you and the other men had in the whole the ejection seat and the whole system for getting you safely to the ground if you were outside the aircraft?
We felt pretty good about it. We practiced it constantly. There was a requirement, and I believe it was twice a year, that we had to go, and they had a simulator trainer for the seat to practice ejecting and also practice emergency egress on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So we felt pretty good that it would work. But we knew that a lot of times the situation itself lent itself to injury.
Yes, sir.
Being too close to the ground, too fast, upside down. So, I mean, we thought that given a chance, the system generally worked and worked correctly and worked well.
Now, while you were in country, did you have to keep up those skills? And
yes, we still did that.
Okay. And was there a facility at Phucat for you to work through those test trials?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you get the day off when you were doing that?
No, it took a couple of hours at the most.
Oh, really? Did you ever I know you said that you didn't believe that you were going to be hurt. Did you think that you might ever have to eject? Did it ever occur to you that you might have to go through that?
One time.
Can you tell me about it?
When we were on a mission, and I think I told you about this last time,
Captain
Gray and I, and we got a little bit disoriented on where we were pulling off the target, and we're too close to the mountain.
The mountain, yeah.
And actually hit the top of a tree. Brought home some green marks with us. But, I mean, I well remember that I grabbed for the ejection handle
mm-hmm.
and muttered an obscenity. And was particularly mad when I figured out that the guard over the thing, when I had pushed it down when we took off, had popped back up. And I was either going to have to push it down, which took that much longer, or forget it. By then it was too late anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And we managed to get out of the situation.
Right, without having to go to the extreme.
Right. I mean, I was that close.
And you were
yes, that scared me.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I remember you telling me that it did scare you. It scared me to listen to it, quite frankly. Sir, I want to ask you about your flight into Cambodia. Can you describe the circumstances under which you first entered Cambodian airspace?
Sure. Mm-hmm. It was on May the 1st, 1970,
yes.
Not that I remember.
Yes, sir.
But we were the first warship in. And you can imagine that there were many, many, many people there, airborne. There were airborne controllers. There was very specific forward controllers marking targets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were just a lot of people, and there were a lot of airplanes going at one time. I would venture to guess there were hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
The amazing thing to us was that when you overflew South Vietnam, other than in the cities themselves, there were no structures. They had all been bombed to pieces. There were no bridges. The roads were blown up. There were no houses to speak of.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we go into Cambodia, and they actually have buildings still standing and bridges and towns and cities. And our particular target happened to be some warehouses. And it was just amazing to have actual targets you could see.
That was a new experience for you,
oh,
really.
Yes. We could see small arms fire. That was one of the times, as I recall, we brought a hole home with us.
Mm-hmm.
Small hole. But we were excited to feel like we were doing something, but it was not that exciting.
Do you remember that mission briefing?
I remember more the mission itself.
Okay. Can you tell me what you felt like? Now, you said you were in the first warship going over.
Yes.
Did you feel like, to some extent, the chains were off and now authorization had been given for you to hit targets that needed to be hit? Is that what you felt?
Well, to be truthful, I felt like it was a short-lived thing. I really didn't think we were going to continue going there. And really, after the initial thrust for probably a week or slightly longer, it was routine humdrum. It was a thrill to go at first. It was exciting because there were a lot of aircraft. Generally speaking, there would be three aircraft, the two F-4 fighters and a forward air controller, and here we were with literally hundreds of people. So there was a lot of excitement, but we didn't think that would last. We knew that it wouldn't be long till there wouldn't be any buildings and bridges that you could see. And we didn't really feel like that we were going to make that much of an impact anyway, because by then, things were beginning to wind down.
That's true. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that on that first flight over, you had a target that was a warehouse. Do you know where that was? Or
that was in the Parrot's Beak area, which is right where Cambodia and Laos and South Vietnam come together.
Mm-hmm.
It's a piece of Cambodia that juts out into Vietnam.
So for you, that wasn't a hugely long additional trip.
No, not really.
Mm-hmm. What about the other guys in the flight that day? Did you talk to them afterwards about what it was you were doing and whether it was a good idea or a good mission?
Oh, we all felt it was a good mission and that we hit the targets that we were after, but we didn't make any political comments.
Right. What about the other planes in the flight? Did they also take a bit of damage? Do you know?
I don't think so. I don't remember anyone saying it.
Uh-huh. Were you aware either, over the next couple of days or as time went on a little bit later on about the controversy inside the U.S. about the incursion into Cambodia?
We were aware of it, yes.
Uh-huh. Did it have any effect on you at all?
No.
None?
I mean, I was doing my job.
Yes, sir. Did you think that that what you were doing was contributing then to a larger war effort that was just part of what you had been doing before and what you keep on doing?
It was nothing more than a minor extension.
Okay.
I didn't think it was going to go any more toward winning a war. I didn't, by then, really feel like we were going to do anything more than just be there a long time.
Mm-hmm. And that the war itself probably wasn't going to change because of this decision.
No, I didn't think so.
Okay. How many missions did you actually fly over Cambodia, do you know?
Oh, not, I could guess, but I don't know an exact number. It wouldn't have been more than about 20.
Okay. And if you recall, what were some of the other targets that you were sent to hit?
Well, originally, we bombed only along the Cambodian-Vietnamese-Laotian border,
okay.
or primarily there. As time went on, we got further inland, and they were generally storage points or suspected storage points. We didn't have troops in Cambodia, so we didn't have troops in contact, but it was mostly storage areas or sometimes truck parks, that type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember specifically in the intelligence briefing, if we were getting anywhere near some historical landmark, such as there's a big lake in Cambodia called Tonle Sap.
Yes, sir.
And there are Buddhist monuments all the way around this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we were severely cautioned, do not bomb these.
Really? Don't even get close to them?
Well, don't even get close.
Uh-huh. And how did you process that order? What did it make you think?
I thought it was right. I thought it was proper.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were small areas, and even if there were enemy soldiers or supplies in there, it was not going to make that much difference. And I didn't think that the loss of something that historically significant was worth it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I wonder if everybody who heard that kind of an order would have had that, you know, sensitivity to the historical significance of
we were used to it back then. I mean, we had more things we couldn't bomb than things we could.
Uh-huh. So this sounded kind of familiar
just,
in a way.
Yeah, it's just one more.
Mm-hmm. So were you then, Ronnie, responsible for keeping track of where you were in relation to those no-go target areas and keeping track of...
Well, to some extent, yes. I mean, we knew where they were, and I kept account of where we were in airspace at any particular time, but the forward air controller, who was the guy that identified the targets on scene,
right.
He was the guy that was responsible primarily to keep us out of that area.
Mm-hmm. Did you work with the same FAC unit?
No,
most
different
of the time,
every time.
Different every time?
Yeah.
Did that introduce any difficulties in communication?
No, we had a lot of faith in those guys that they knew what they were doing, and they were really pretty good at what they did.
Mm-hmm.
We always thought pretty high. We thought they were crazy for going down that low and that slow. But
about what altitude would they have been flying?
Oh, not more than probably 1,000 to 3,000 feet.
And what aircraft generally were those guys flying?
Well, there was an O-1 and an O-2 and an OB-10. OB-10s came along late in the war, and there were very, very few of them. O-1s were a little tricycle landing gear.
Right, the Otter?
Yeah, and the O-2 was a push-pull.
Okay, by push-pull, if somebody didn't know what that was, could
you explain? Two engines, one on the front of the airplane, one on the back. One pushed, one pulled. And they were a little faster, could maneuver a little bit better, and they had better armament. I mean, they actually had a few things other than rockets. The little O-1 thing, I mean, all they had was a rocket.
Which was for marking purposes.
Yeah, and a pistol.
Uh-huh, right.
And the guy in the O-2 at least had a machine gun.
Uh-huh.
So, but it really didn't matter to us because our expectation was that they'd give us the target, mark it for us, and get out of the way.
And we'll take it from there?
That's right.
Okay.
Don't let me run into you because you'll die. I probably won't.
Right. Just by virtue of what you're,
that's right.
Each of you were flying in.
I will take your wing off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sir, I want to ask you a little bit about your correspondence and communication with your family. Were you ever able to call your wife, say, on telephone?
Yeah.
You were?
Probably not very often, three or four times.
Uh-huh.
It was Mars Military Affiliate Radio Station.
How'd that work?
Not really very well. It usually was in the middle of the night, and the reason for that is that that's when they had the best ability to communicate. It was all by HF radio.
Uh-huh.
And when they could get through to the States, that's just generally the time of day that you could do it. And, I mean, it wasn't as though I could call Mars and say, I want to call home. They would call us and say, we've got an opening. Anybody want to call home? And they would call the alert shack usually first because those guys were awake.
Right.
So if you were fortunate enough to be there on alert when they called, you could probably get through.
And do you remember those phone calls?
Oh, yeah, very poor quality.
Uh-huh.
You always had to say over because you were dealing with radio.
Yes.
A couple of times were just general information. I had two times that were specific. One, I had called them and told them, look, if you get through, I need to talk to my wife, because it was right after the tornado.
And that would be the tornado in Lubbock?
Right.
In
1970.
The spring of the, summer of 1970?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly when it was,
okay.
But I had no way to communicate with my wife.
And you were concerned. How did you know that there had been a tornado?
Oh, it was in Stars and Stripes.
Oh, was it really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. It was devastating. I read a little bit about it. So
she was going to school there.
Yes, sir.
You know, tore up the car, a few things like that. And
really?
I mean, it was probably a good week before I could get in touch with her.
How would you describe yourself during that week? Were you
pretty concerned about her?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't know what to do. I thought, well, I guess I could go to the Red Cross, but they probably had more important things to do. But finally, I did get through on the Mars radio.
And what did she tell you? What was her take on what had happened?
It was like, well, what were you worried about? I would have called you if I were dead. You know, what's the big deal? She did describe it to me and told me it was pretty bad, but that where she was not nearly so bad as downtown. She was sort of out on the south side of town.
Uh-huh.
Probably
I'm
guessing 24th, 25th, 26th Street, somewhere along there.
Okay, and a large number of people were killed in that tornado,
yes.
Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. And there was some damage to her car and the little place where she lived. It was no big deal to her.
Uh-huh, but I'm sure she understood that you were concerned.
Yes.
What was the other specific time you called? That you
When I was trying to decide where I was going to go when I left Vietnam.
Okay, can you tell me about that situation?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, when we were getting on toward the end of our duty in Vietnam, and I don't remember the time, but it was probably a good 2 months before we were due to leave,
mm-hmm.
we filled out what was called a dream sheet. And that was, you know, what's your dream place to go for your next assignment? Well, coming out of Vietnam, they tried very hard to let you go where you wanted to go. And so you had a number of choices, and I was sort of torn. I had a choice of going back to the States and flying this same airplane, or I could go to back to Air Training Command and be an instructor where I had gone to navigator school.
That would be in Sacramento?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought very seriously about that. I liked that part of the world, and my
yes.
wife had relatives out there. And I thought very seriously about going there and had even indicated at first that's where I wanted to go. But I called my wife and said, look, I've talked to several people, and they tell me that it's easy to get to Germany if we want to go. And she said, sure, I want to go.
Now, she was completing her studies at Tech.
By then, she was done.
She was done?
She finished in the summer.
Okay.
And this would have been in the fall.
Right. And why was she keen to go to Germany? Can you describe her interest?
Oh, sure. She's young and wanted to travel like me.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have any children, and
right.
you know, we were ready to go.
So it was potentially a great adventure.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. And so you called her up to sort of get her take on...
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that's what she did want to do, that
uh-huh.
she didn't... I mean, I didn't expect her to not want to, but I wanted to make sure she didn't have some violent reaction to it.
Right. And can you... can you describe, if you remember, that phone call?
Oh, she was happy. She was uh-huh. ecstatic. She hadn't even thought about that possibility.
Uh-huh.
And she thought it was a great idea. I mean, she immediately said, yes, I'd love to go.
And you were looking at, what, another 2 years over there?
36 months.
36 months, okay. In addition to those two particular times that you called and spoke to your wife, were you also in correspondence with her a lot?
At least once a day, and if I didn't write a letter, I got a letter asking me why I didn't write a letter that day.
And did she return the favor?
Every day.
Really?
Every day.
And how was your mail delivery? Was it pretty consistent?
when the weather was good, it was very good. It would get erratic if the weather was bad. I mean, they were going to take great chances to come in there. But like during the monsoon, we had, 2 weeks we didn't get any mail.
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot at one time when they finally did come.
And did you read them in order?
Yeah, I tried to figure out which one.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I would go 3 days with nothing and then get 3 or 4 letters.
Yeah.
So, you know, we didn't get every single day mail delivery.
Mm-hmm. But that's pretty good. And did you kind of, what role did those letters play for you?
Well, first of all, you know, it made me feel that she was okay.
Yes.
Still, at least on that day.
Yes.
I mean, I've asked her if she felt the same way. She said, you know, the letters came so late that you could have been dead a week by the time I got the letter, for all I knew. I said, but, you know, I always felt like it made me feel like things were okay.
And reassuring in that way.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And did she talk to you about stuff that was going on in town here, or family matters? Or?
Oh, more family matters
uh-huh.
than anything else. I mean, truthfully, Tech was a pretty quiet school.
Yes, sir. Still is in some ways.
Yeah.
And what kinds of things would you write to her, and were there things you just wouldn't write to her about?
Oh, you know, once in a while we would lose an aircraft, and I'd write to her and assure her that I wasn't in that thing.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit about what was going on in the States, not a lot, because we didn't get that much information. We used to laugh about it being the bra-burning time.
That's right. And your reference there is to the women's movement?
Right.
Uh-huh.
You know, and we'd talk a little bit about that, but it was more just correspondence to be correspondence. I mean, a lot of times it's probably a page, page and a half long.
Sure.
At the most.
And that was just kind of a way to say I'm okay?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Might tell her about what I did or if I'd been somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And, sir, you know, earlier you mentioned the sound equipment that you got, and I wonder if you were also taking pictures at all. Did you have a camera?
I bought a camera when I went to Hong Kong,
mm-hmm.
and I did take pictures later on. I was never a great photographer. I have a few pictures, not that many.
Mm-hmm. And you were, at the time you bought that camera, you were getting closer and closer to the time that you were actually.
I was thinking more in terms of using it for Germany than
mm-hmm.
Vietnam.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. How did you feel? Can you describe your feelings, if any, as you approached the time that you were going to leave in January of 71?
I can remember asking someone, "What do you do with the spare time?" I mean, we had so much downtime there that we didn't do anything but drink or cause problems. You know, you know when you get back to the States or to Germany or wherever you're going to the real world, what the heck do you do with your spare time?
Right, because you're not on call and
that's
not
right.
With the adrenaline rush and all. Everything.
You know, and we had people who had been on they'd been on one tour and they were back for their second tour, and they, you know, they always laughed and said, "Don't worry, you'll fill your time."
Did it ever occur to you to have another tour in Vietnam?
Never.
There was no way that anyone was going to persuade you for that.
No.
Did anyone try?
We were asked if we as a group, not individually,
mm-hmm.
were told that if we would agree to a 6-month extension, they would allow us to select the base and where we wanted to go, including Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just as an inducement to get you to stay.
And that just wasn't going to work for you.
And I had no intention of doing that. Very few people did.
Right.
I know a few who did.
Uh-huh.
Most of them I consider not at the same intelligent level as a normal human.
And was that your best clue that they didn't, that they weren't, that they were kind of subpar?
Yeah. Well, I don't know that they, I mean, one guy I know who did it
mm-hmm.
was a friend of mine, and I, to this day, I don't really understand it. One of them was this guy that was, I mean, he was a loser to me. I mean, you know, why would you do that? And one guy was so bad, they said, "No, we don't want you."
Really?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, out of the whole time I was there, maybe 3 people asked to stay.
Yeah, most people were interested in going the other way.
There were a number of backseat pilots
mm-hmm.
who wanted to upgrade to the front seat and were willing to take a second tour.
Now, those were, I would assume, career people?
Yeah, mostly.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And their interest in getting to the front seat would be what?
To be an aircraft commander.
Uh-huh. And because,
be in charge.
Uh-huh. And it would be important for them later on in their career mm-hmm. to
have. Oh, you had to do that.
Yes, sir. Do you remember the day that you were ready to, that you were leaving Vietnam?
Oh, sure.
Can you tell me about that day and how it happened and what you were thinking that day?
Well, first of all, Phuket was remote from any other bases. So you had to get from Phuket to wherever your charter aircraft was to go back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, it was Cameron Bay.
Okay.
So you had a couple of days. You stopped flying 5 days before your, what we call deroast, due to return from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd use that time to pack and out process. So you had a little downtime getting ready.
And that was standard?
Yeah, 5 days. That was the normal.
Okay.
And so you packed your things. You got the people to come over and pick them up. You out-processed, which is you got your orders and, you know, when signed out and so forth, got your final pay if you needed your pay and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And made your final arrangements. Then you had to get to Cameron Bay. And as I sort of alluded to before, transportation was a little slipshod.
Yes.
I mean, my orders read, forward yourself to Cameron Bay and get on this airplane and go to the States.
You more or less had to figure out how to start that up.
So, I mean, you leave at least 2 days early just to make sure you get there on time. So there was a lot of excitement, of course. There were several of us going at the same time, so we were kind of in a bunch. But I so well remember when we got there, we had to, again, scratch for a place to spend the night. And fortunately, we did find one. But as we were about to get on the airplane, we were having to go through customs.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, here was a bunch of guys that were, all we wanted to do was go home. And they were searching our bags for contraband. And they were looking for drugs. They were looking for pornography, anything that we weren't supposed to take with us. And all we wanted to do, I mean, you know, take my bags. I don't care. I'm going home.
Right. Take it all.
Burn it. I don't care.
Yes, sir.
You know, just get out of the way.
Uh-huh.
But as we were just about to get on, there was a flight that had landed, probably the same airplane that we were about to get on. Guys coming in, going to the base that I left. And we were laughing about them, about being our replacements.
Uh-huh. Did you experience any kind of pangs of sadness when you were leaving some of the guys you've been flying with?
Absolutely not.
Really?
All I wanted to do was get out of that place.
Okay. Did they throw a party for you or anything?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We had a monthly party.
Oh, a monthly party.
Yeah. We had a party at the Officers Club every month, and it was to welcome the guys coming in and say goodbye to the guys leaving and say goodbye to anyone who might have been killed.
Yes, sir. And so the party in January,
that would have been mine, yeah,
was for you to get out of there.
Right.
You said that there were kind of a bunch of you leaving at the same time. Were those guys from the same squadron?
Yes, people that I had gone over with.
Okay. Sir, can you describe your feeling about leaving with, you know, those guys? You know, you had all survived it.
Oh, of course, we all swore fidelity and that we'd keep in touch. And a few of them I managed to go and see again. But
mm-hmm.
I mean, once we got on the airplane, it was all over.
Yeah. Was that a bit sad for you later on as you thought about it?
Yeah. One of the fellows that I was laughing at who was coming in as I was leaving.
Yes.
Believe it or not, a year later showed up at the base in the same squadron I was in Germany. And we still laughed about it.
Is that right? That's strange. That plane flight out of Vietnam, where did it take you?
We flew to Yokota Air Base, Japan,
okay,
and refueled,
uh-huh,
and then took off from there and flew to Seattle, Washington.
And how long were you there?
Well, so we left at 9:30 in the morning. I'm sorry, we left at 7:30 in the morning,
mm-hmm,
and we got to Seattle at 9:30 the same morning after 17 hours.
Yes, sir.
And, of course, we were a little tired, but I had a ticket from Seattle to Dallas, and my ticket was for, like, noon, so I had to hurry. And where we landed was at, I think it's McCord Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
No, I can't remember the name of it, but it's in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
But my flight was out of SeaTac,
yes,
Seattle-Tacoma, so I had to get from one place to the other. So I had to get through customs mm-hmm. and get to SeaTac in time to make that plane. So I was in a very big hurry.
That's a heck of a connection.
And, well, I had about 2.5 hours to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that far between the two.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the thing I remember most is standing in these long lines trying to get through customs. And you got these guys that, I mean, they're as bored about it as we are.
Right.
I mean, they're just there trying to get it over with. But, I mean, they were doing such stupid things. Like, you know, they make you take everything out of all your bags, which delayed you forever. They if you had a can of talcum powder, they had this long steel rod that they stuck down in there and smelled of it to see what was in there. And it made you take everything out of your pockets. And,
mm-hmm.
It was just not a good experience. It's like we were criminals.
Right, and primarily they were looking for drugs, is that what you think?
That's exactly what they were looking for.
Did it kind of hock you off a little bit that you'd been over there serving? And
that's kind of my feeling.
Yeah.
I felt like, so what if I smoked a little grass? I mean, what difference does it make? I'm back.
Right. And
you're Which on, I didn't, by the way.
Right, and you're on my time now, right?
That's
right.
If
you want to get to Dallas, I am sure, to see your wife.
I've got to get out of here.
Yeah. And your plan was to meet your wife in Dallas?
No, I had to go to Dallas and then go on to Lubbock.
Oh, okay. Oh, right. Right. And how long were you likely to be here in Lubbock as a break before you went on to Germany?
Well, I had to report to Germany on, I think it was February the 7th.
Okay.
Was
oh,
my
okay.
report date.
Uh-huh. So you had a couple of weeks?
I had 3 weeks at least.
That's great.
Because I got back on the 15th of January.
And I assume that you were helping your wife get ready to then move overseas.
She had done a lot of that already.
Good for her.
And
smart girl.
All of the, like the inoculations and the paperwork, passport and so forth and so on.
Uh-huh.
I had corresponded with her and told her, you need to go to Reese and do this and that.
Right.
So she had that pretty well done. We didn't own enough. We didn't own any furniture.
Uh-huh.
We did have to get to Philadelphia to drop the car off because we were taking our car with us. But, I mean, the biggest logistical nightmare was visit all the relatives before we left again.
Yeah, because they
I've already been gone a year, and my mom kind of wanted to see me.
Right.
I was about to leave for another 4 years.
Yeah, how did that go with seeing your mom?
Well, that was great because she actually came up to Lubbock, mm-hmm. where my sister was, and so I got to see her there. We stayed there probably a week, as I recall, and then we went and visited her parents. They lived close to Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And then went back and visited mine again.
Can you talk about your mom's reaction to clapping eyes on you finally after
all
this time?
Well, of course she was happy. My mom was never, she's pretty stoic.
Uh-huh.
She was not an excitable type person. She had a pretty rough life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I mean, she was glad to see me. I don't recall tears,
mm-hmm.
More joy than anything else. And I just wanted to go to bed. I mean, I've been up for 30-some-odd hours by the time I finally got home.
Yes, sir.
And I was tired. My internal clock's all messed up.
Yeah.
I want to go to bed.
And so you slept for a couple days, maybe?
No. I went to sleep probably by the time I got to bed, it was midnight, and at 2:30 in the morning, my eyes are wide open.
Oh, no.
My time's so screwed up.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And, of course, by 7 a.m., I want to go back to bed.
Right. It's very, very hard to get readjusted.
Oh, yeah.
Sir, did you drive to Philadelphia then?
Yes.
Okay.
We stayed there in Lubbock for a few days.
Uh-huh.
And I had a visit from a friend of mine who lived in Oklahoma City, and I can't remember what he was doing, but he came down. He and his wife came and visited with us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we made our relative visits and drove to Philadelphia via Washington, D.C., where I had another friend that we stopped by to see.
In your travels during that 3-week period, did you encounter anyone or group of people who were overtly anti-war or took a look at you kind of funny because you looked like a military person?
Not really, but remember, first of all, I'm in Texas, which
yes,
is
sir.
A pretty conservative state.
Yes, sir.
And I was in two small towns.
Okay.
And on the way to Philadelphia, it was just hurry, 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 so we never really... We didn't have much time. It was dead of winter, February.
Mm-hmm. So So, so you didn't.
I never had that problem.
Okay.
I never had any particular welcome arms, but I never had someone say anything untoward to me or act in any way that I took as offensive until much later.
Okay. How much later?
Well, that was, I think I told you about that. Years later, when a fellow told me, you know, made the statement to me that the only people who went to Vietnam were the stupid ones.
Right. Right. that was nice. Going over to Germany, how did you and your wife actually travel?
We went to, I guess that was McFord Air Force Base in New Jersey, mm-hmm. and took a charter flight, which they push you in with cattle prods by the hundreds.
Yes, sir.
We dropped the car off in Philadelphia and took a bus from Philadelphia to Trenton, New Jersey, which is a couple of hours, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And spent the night there and then flew over on a charter airplane to Frankfurt, Germany.
Had your wife been outside the country before?
Never.
Okay. Can you tell about your reactions upon arriving and what base did you actually settle at in Germany?
Well, first of all, it was bitter cold.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
I mean, Lubbock was cold, but I, you know, I haven't warmed up in a month. You know, I came from Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of lonesome because at the time, there were a lot of people in Europe in the American military, and Rhein-Main in Frankfurt was a huge, huge base.
Uh-huh.
And they had told us that there would be someone there to meet us, to give us a ride to the base, because it was about a 3-4 hour drive. So when we got there, we kind of stood around wondering, you know, well, now what? And finally, someone paged us, and it was the guy that was there to pick us up to give us a ride, and we went to, he took us to temporary quarters in Germany, Bitburg, Germany.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
And we stayed there for, gosh, a couple weeks, I guess, until we found a place to live.
And you were able to find a place on your own?
Well, they had a housing office there,
mm-hmm.
that was the kind of liaison between the German public, if you were going to live on the economy. It was also the place that assigned base housing. So you went over there and told them what type of housing you were looking for, and then, you know, they had something available to say, okay, here it is, go look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So we wound up actually going to, there are two air bases there right almost next door to each other, Spengdahlem and Bitburg.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. And Bitburg base housing was full, but I didn't want to live on the base anyway. I wanted to live out on the economy.
Yes.
But it was so busy then with all these people returning from Vietnam that it was hard to find a place to live. So we took quarters at Spengdahlem, the next base over, temporary.
Mm-hmm.
And as luck would have it, they actually closed the runway at Bitburg and moved us to Spengdahlem for a couple of months because they were working on the runway.
Oh, okay.
So we lived at Spengdahlem and worked at Spengdahlem for the first couple of months.
And after that, did you go out and find something in the private?
Well, actually, before we moved back to Bitburg, before the squadron moved back to Bitburg, we found a place to live.
Now, which squadron were you attached to, sir?
It was called the 53rd Tech Fighter Squadron.
Okay. And how many aircraft did they have? And were they all F-4s or what else?
They were all F-4s. There were three squadrons there.
Okay.
The 22nd Squadron, the 53rd Squadron, there was one called the 525th, which had a little bit different mission, but was the same type of, same aircraft, but a later model.
What was the 525th doing?
They were air-to-air defense.
Okay. And the 53rd primarily was involved
in air-to-ground.
Okay. And when did you first start flying over in Germany? How long have you been there?
Oh, gosh, I didn't get more than a few days to get signed in.
Uh-huh.
Because they were gearing up for a deployment to go to Spain.
Going to Spain?
Pardon me.
Okay.
And we rotated down once a quarter to your gunnery practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to get ready for that. So I flew pretty soon after I got there.
Okay. And what was your wife busy doing?
Well, at first, of course, she was busy getting us situated in where we lived and meeting some people. Well, fortunately, we had a fellow in the little small town where we were that we knew, he and his wife.
Okay.
They'd been at Sacramento with us. So we at least had friends.
Yeah, that's helpful.
And another friend of mine that I'd known ever since I'd been in the Air Force happened to get stationed there also, so we would go and visit them.
Mm-hmm.
So we had, plenty. Plus, we, you know, we played the tourist as much as we could.
Sure. What kinds of things did you do as a tourist?
Well, it's like anything else. When you first get there, you're a little bit tentative, so you stay close to home. But there, I mean, there's so many things to see.
Mm-hmm.
There were castles right there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's 12 miles to Luxembourg.
Right.
And it's 20 miles to France. And it's like 30 miles to Belgium. So we had plenty of places to go without having to venture too far.
Mm-hmm.
But as time went on, we went every place we could possibly go.
And you said that you had brought your car over?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did that make it a lot easier to kind of pick up and go?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
We did have to make arrangements. A fellow loaned us a car when we first got there for a couple of days. But our car got there not very far behind us. But it came into Hamburg, Germany.
Uh-huh.
And there were enterprising airmen who, for a small amount of money, would go and get your car for you.
And bring it down?
Yeah.
How?
They would drive it.
They would drive it back down?
They'll pick it up. You gave them the paperwork.
Uh-huh.
And you had to buy ration coupons for fuel. And paid them $50, and they went to... It rode the train up, got your car, and brought it to you. It was a good deal.
Yeah, that was great. Because Hamburg is a bit of a bit
oh, that's
of a, go.
A pretty good haul.
Yes, sir.
Probably at least an 8-hour train. Right?
Yeah, it's quite a wait. How did you settle into to the different routine now? You're in a different squadron. You're in a different environment, a different climate. Did it feel since you
try to come down? To be truthful,
is that right? How so, sir?
Well, in Vietnam, you didn't spend time training. You spent time doing and you suddenly you have all these training requirements. You have to get this done, get that done. You have to fill this square, do this, make sure you got, you know, and you have new jobs to do, and most of the people you're flying with are new people. You're trying to feel each other out and see how that's going to work out, and who do you like, who you don't like,
mm-hmm.
who do you want to fly with, that type thing.
And did you locate someone that you were going to be flying with on a more or less regular basis as you had in Vietnam?
Not really. They just didn't do that there.
Okay, it didn't gel in the same way?
Yeah, it just, you just flew with whoever you were assigned to. And that was not true just of me, that was everybody.
Right. Would it be true to say that the sort of feeling and camaraderie was just different because it wasn't...
It was different. There was a camaraderie. I mean, there was a friendly battle ongoing with the other squadrons. It just so happened that the squadron that I was in had as their mascot on their patch was a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And several years before, some enterprising guy had put together a NATO tiger meet. And all of the squadrons, no matter what country... that had a tiger or anything you could stretch your imagination to think it's a tiger,
mm-hmm.
would get together and do a little friendly competition and a little, whole lot of drinking and a whole lot of talking and have a little deal. And they did it every 4 years.
Uh-huh.
And it had just occurred a year or so before I got there, so they were gearing up for the next one, and it was going to be held at that base.
And what year did it take place?
70... Five, I believe, right after I left.
Okay.
So the first one would have been in 71. I guess one went on somewhere else while I was there.
Okay.
I didn't go. I kind of wanted to go, but I didn't get to go.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we only sent two aircraft. That kind of made a sense of camaraderie.
Sure, yeah.
Plus, you keep running into people you know. I mean, I'd been in the military since 1967, and we're in 1971, so I mean, I had met people over time that I knew.
Right. What year did you actually leave Germany?
1974.
And is that also the year that you separated from?
Yes, so I separated when I left Germany.
Okay. Tell me about your decision to actually leave the Air Force.
I don't know that it was really a true decision so much as an extension of what I'd planned all along. I never intended to make it a career.
Uh-huh.
It was one of those things, as I explained before, it was my means of draft dodging. And it was not that appealing to me.
Okay.
I didn't like being sort of the second-class citizen. By that, I mean I didn't like riding in the back seat.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. So I had decided that I was going to go get some job that paid $300,000 a year in the States.
Mm-hmm.
I made it very plain. I didn't pretend I was going to make it a career.
Uh-huh.
And there were probably as many people who weren't sure that they were going to make it a career as there were those who were sure they were not going to. I was probably as sure as anyone that I was not going to.
And was there an effort to sort of change your mind?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, can you describe what sorts of things were put on your plate as possibilities for you?
Well,
that didn't attract you, obviously, but...
It was some a little tempting, but not enough to make me stay.
Mm-hmm.
When you are not an Academy graduate or not an honors graduate through ROTC, you actually are not in the regular Air Force. You are in the Reserve Air Force. So I was a reserve officer.
Okay.
Assigned to active duty. That may be, if you don't understand what I'm talking about, I'll try to explain it a little better. But
sure. It would be good if you went into it just a bit.
Well, a regular officer was a career officer in the regular Air Force full-time.
Mm-hmm.
A reserve officer, on the other hand, had a commitment and then served at the discretion of the Air Force after that.
So
all young men had a six-year commitment at that point in time to the military,
mm-hmm.
unless you were physically non-qualified, whether that be in the reserve or full-time reserve, part-time reserve, full-time reserve, or regular Air Force. You had a six-year commitment,
mm-hmm.
and how you filled it just depended on what you did. So I went in as a reserve officer. I was on active duty full-time, but I was not in the regular Air Force.
Okay.
And I was probably like 75% of the people. If they decide they want to keep you in the military, then they will ask you, if we decide to offer you one, will you accept a commission in the regular Air Force? That's like, if we offer you this job full-time for 20 years, will you take it?
Right.
And at the time, I was pretty sure I was going to get out, but it was not very long after I'd gotten to Germany, so I sort of said, okay, sure.
Uh-huh.
Never thinking too much about it, because things were winding down. The war ended. There were tons of people that had been sent home from Vietnam, and we were bursting at the seams with people, and they started rifting people.
Yes.
Reduction in force.
Yes, sir.
So I just assumed, they're not going to say anything to me. Lo and behold, they came along and said, we'd like to offer you a regular commission.
Uh-huh.
And I had to say yes or no. If I took it, there was another commitment involved. I said, no, I'm not going to do it. So as a consequence, I had to sit through counseling, first by a lower-ranking major, and then I had to go to the lieutenant colonel, and then I had to go to the full colonel, and I just told them all. I had made up my mind.
And each one of these guys was... Putting the carrot and stick, maybe.
Yeah, it explains to me why it was a great career and why they thought that I would do well and should continue.
What did they say about your service, such that they were, even in a period of ripping, interested in bringing
they,
you in?
The people they wanted to keep were those who were well qualified and skilled at what they did and had combat experience.
Mm-hmm. And did they talk to you about the kinds of things that you might be doing in a future career?
Well, what they did is, I didn't immediately just say no. I just
right.
told them I'd think about it. So they started giving me these little jobs that were supposed to broaden my career, make
okay.
me more promotable.
Such as?
Well, I taught. I was the only navigator who taught in the required ground school that everybody had to attend.
Mm-hmm.
All the other guys were pilots.
What Was there a particular name for that school?
Well, it was called ground school. It was called instrument school is what it was called.
Uh-huh.
But it was there were a number of training requirements that you had to fill. I don't think it was every 6 months, but it may have been once a year.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you had to, I don't even remember what all they were, but I remember what I taught was the procedures for flying in or near the buffer zone between us and the eastern countries and us and the neutral countries.
And was the instrument school on the base?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But it was I taught two classes each time I taught it, and it was all day long.
Uh-huh. That's hard work, too.
I enjoyed it.
Did you?
You know, it was strictly lecture.
Right.
And I had, you know, you do it three times, you got it memorized. Because I taught the same thing every time. It would be like being a school teacher, but you teach the same thing every day.
Right, and as you say, it wasn't a discussion class.
No.
Right. Uh-huh.
And
what else did they have you do?
Well, they also gave me a job at Wing Headquarters, which is above the squadron,
mm-hmm.
in the weapon shop. And they didn't really have anything for me to do, but they thought it sounded good.
Okay.
And that got boring real fast. So they figured out that, you know, they didn't really have that much for me to do, so they put me in charge of keeping all of the training records for the whole squadron.
And what was the position title for that?
It was called the training shop, and it was just kind of a separate little place where two or three people were assigned, and they had to track all of the training requirements that you had and when you completed them.
Okay.
And I had a couple of guys who worked for me,
mm-hmm.
and I kept the records, and I kept a huge grease board up there. I kept manual records, but I kept it posted on this big grease board because the scheduler would get what we're flying for the next two or three or four days, he would have to come in and see, okay, we're flying this type of mission. Who needs it?
Oh, I see. Who needs it in terms of where they are
right.
in their own training?
You know, radar bomb scoring or low level or, you know, air-to-air or whatever.
Mm-hmm. What else did they find for you to do, or was that the last thing?
That was the most important one.
Okay.
But that was also the one that made up my mind I would not make the military a career because they figured out that was really a place of command because I had a couple of guys working for me.
Mm-hmm.
And they really wanted the pilots to be in command.
Okay, and again, that was sort of sorting out the pilots from the backseaters.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy they wanted to put in there, I happened to outrank him by like 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I outrank him, he cannot write my efficiency report. He can't be the guy that grades me. So I had to answer to him, but my efficiency report was written by the ops officer who was a major. He was the guy that did the scheduling.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I considered that a patent insult.
Yeah, and this kind of galvanized your...
And that's when I said, you know, I'm putting in my papers, I'm getting out.
Okay. And what year did... Or, I'm sorry, it was in 1974, but what month did you actually separate from?
April 1st.
Okay.
That was my official separation date.
And where did you and your wife go after your termination as an Air Force Reserve officer?
We're stretching this way past Vietnam.
Yes, sir. We just want to kind of, you know, bring
the career to an end.
Well, a little bit, and I also want to ask you about how you felt after in 1975, a year later, when South Vietnam finally fell to North Vietnamese.
When we came back to the States, we landed in Charleston, South Carolina.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And out processed there, spent a few days there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was April 1st, so the weather was beginning to get nice anyway. And drove from there to Dallas, or near Dallas, where mm-hmm. her parents lived, and visited with them because that was the first place relatives were. And then we left there and went to visit my folks. And in the meantime, I had saved my money diligently. I did not have to go to work after you for a good 6 months if I didn't want to.
Uh-huh.
But I just happened to look in the Dallas paper, and there was a job fair being held, and specifically name wanted ex-military officers. I said, well, I'd be a fool not to at least go look.
And find out about it. Uh-huh.
And I probably hadn't been back but a week then, so...
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. I went on to visit my folks. I sent my resume in, and I went on to visit my folks, and they notified me that I needed to be at this job fair thing on such and such a date. So I flew back to Dallas and interviewed with several people. And lo and behold, they gave me a job.
And, sir, fast-forwarding a little bit then to 1975 when South Vietnam ceased to exist, did you have any particular feelings about the end of the war?
I was extremely bitter. I was embarrassed. I don't know that I felt like that I had done anything to let my country down. I thought people had let us down. That if we didn't think enough of it to see it through to the end, then why did we do it at all? I lost 6 good friends in my squadron while I was there. And I was pretty upset about that.
Mm-hmm. And, sir, have you changed your mind in the 30-plus years since? 30 years since?
Well, I probably don't hate Jane Fonda quite as much.
Mm-hmm.
But I've mellowed. I don't hold it against anyone. Most of the people who were anti-war, right, wrong, or indifferent, saw well enough that when the war was over, they needed to shut it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't at least strut around and say, we were right.
Right.
It just, I mean, it came to a close, and that was the end of it. I didn't expect, personally, for me, anything. I didn't ask for anything.
Right.
Just leave me alone. I did what I was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. Leave me alone.
Sir, you mentioned Jane Fonda. Can you say how you felt when you learned that she had gone over to Hanoi? And what was your reaction to that?
I was
appalled.
Uh-huh.
Yes, sir.
I felt like if she wanted to disagree with our having been there, that was her right. But to do what she did was absolutely unjustifiable.
And as I recall, she was at least one of the broadcasts that she made while she was over there, she addressed pilots and flyers particularly.
She did, and she made the statement that she had visited the prisoners who were there, and there was no one who was being mistreated.
Yeah.
Ask John McCain if that's true.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Do you think she was just naive, or was she?
I think she was. Yes, I do think she was naive.
Uh-huh. Was
as
she,
far as how she, I think she is an intelligent woman.
Mm-hmm.
I have no quarrel with her being anti-war. Let me make that very plain. She has her right to that opinion.
Yes, sir.
What she does not have the right to do is to abet the enemy, which is what she did, which was totally, as far as I'm concerned, bordering on treason.
Well,
I feel that strongly about it.
It won't surprise you to learn you're not the only one who has said that.
Well, I just, if someone had assassinated her, I would not have wept. I mean, I felt that strongly about it.
Yeah.
I refuse. I've never watched a Jane Fonda movie in my life, and I never will.
Speaking of movies, sir, have you watched Vietnam films at all?
Some.
Were there any that struck you in a particular way as especially accurate or as especially or egregiously inaccurate?
Oh, I mean, there are some that were egregiously inaccurate.
Uh-huh.
One that I remember was Flight of the Intruder. I mean, that bordered on being ridiculous.
What was wrong with it?
Well, it was the story of two naval pilots who decided to bomb a utility plant in Hanoi,
mm-hmm.
in direct violation of the rules. Nobody did that. I mean, we did a lot of things, but we weren't blatant about it.
Right. Right. So just the premise of it was...
Yeah, I mean, that's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there was a one called Bat 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
And Bat 2-1 was the story of a couple of fellows, again, in the Navy, who were shot down, and one of them made it out alive after they haven't been on the ground, gosh, 4 or 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a sense of reality to that one.
Right.
But, I mean, I can't connect to things like Apocalypse Now. I wasn't in the Army. I didn't go through those things.
Right.
Full Metal Jacket. I just, that's not how I lived.
Right. It's not the war you saw.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were in a little, small, closed base. But we didn't get off, and essentially none of the bad guys got in. They'd get mad at us and chunk in a few rockets and mortars every now and then. And once in a while get lucky enough to shoot one of our aircraft down, but we didn't have the intensity of full-time combat like those poor Army people did, or Marines.
Mm-hmm.
We went out and had combat at the most an hour and a half a day.
Do you even at this remove from events, feel a kind of disconnect from the war that is often portrayed on television, television programs and the movies, that the infantry and Marines faced while they were over there? Do you still think?
Personally, I have no connect to it.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Because I didn't live through that.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, personally, I don't think that the anti-war sentiment outside of the few hot spots that there were was intense as everybody puts it up to be.
By hot spots, could you name the ones you're thinking of?
Berkeley, Kent State, New York City, Washington, D.C., the East Coast and the West Coast, and very few points in between. I mean, in middle America, people didn't do that.
Did your wife ever say anything to you about any anti-war stuff that went
Never
on
ever.
At Texas Tech?
Never ever.
Okay. Sir, have you read much about the war?
I read. Yes, I have read about it. In fact, you get a little maudling as you get older, and like to remember.
Yes, sir.
I happened to run into via the internet a fellow who wrote a series of books about a similar airplane, the F-105. He was what was called a wild weasel. I don't know if you know what
yes,
that is,
yes,
but he was actually a backseat wild weasel, and I've corresponded with him and read every one of his four or five books.
Mm-hmm.
He lives not far from here.
Does reading about it help you to sort of think through your own experience, or are you reading it for a larger interest in understanding the conflict?
I read it for two reasons.
Okay.
Number one, for a better understanding of the big picture.
Uh-huh.
I had a very limited picture. I was young. I was naive. I was not politically active.
Mm-hmm.
As I grow older, I'd like to look back and say what really was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I like to remember when I was young. Sure, I do. Everybody does.
Sure.
And if you remember, 99% of what we talked about have been the good memories.
Yes, sir.
I mean, we didn't talk about anything bad.
Right.
Or very little.
And that's not because bad things have happened. I'm aware of that.
That's just what you remember and what you want to talk about.
And, sir, with the reading that you've done, can you give your, at this point, your general assessment of U.S. strategy in the conflict overall? Was it a good idea for the United States to commit forces to that conflict or not?
Perhaps at the beginning, when we first went over there, and our idea was containment to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
But once we had been there for a number of years and continued that same poor strategy that wasn't working, looking back at it now, it was a great waste of manpower and money. Of course, hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah.
Looking forward then, we all thought we could win the war tomorrow. Now, looking back, there was never a Chinaman's chance.
Why is that?
Because we didn't go about it as a war. We went about it as keep the casualties down, but make everybody believe that we were trying to win.
And would you say that the United States did not commit the full power to the conflict it might have? Such that a victory...
No, of course we didn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you understand why?
Sure.
Why?
Because of political upheaval that would have come about had they done so.
Okay.
Maybe Midwestern America would become part of the anti-war sentiment at the time. But at that point in time, the war had drug on forever and ever and ever. We had never fought a war that lasted that long.
Yes, sir. That's very true.
People were sick and tired of it, including those of us who had been there.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that President Nixon's plan to Vietnamize the war in the late 60s, of course, 69 onward, was the best approach that could have been formulated at the time?
I don't think he had a lot of choice. Our intent at that time was to get out with the least loss of face that we could do so.
Mm-hmm.
Giving it a name, Vietnamization, was simply our way of bowing out. I don't think there's anyone who in Washington who thought that the South Vietnamese could continue to keep the North out. It was when they would take over. And I honestly believe that. I don't think anyone thought that 10 years from then there would still be two Vietnams.
Even Nixon and Kissinger and the Paris Peace Accords?
No, they didn't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point in time, they were beyond caring.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about being a Vietnam veteran. Other than the one incident that you described where someone said something fairly disparaging about people who served in Vietnam, have you ever encountered any resistance or, for lack of a better word, discrimination because you served in Vietnam?
Quite the opposite.
Okay. Can you describe what you mean by that?
I've had people thank me. I've had people who, when I first came back, I'm convinced that one of the reasons that I got a job was because I was an ex-military officer.
And some employers saw that as a valuable background.
It wasn't a detractor that I had been to Vietnam, but it was the military training made you mature.
Yes, sir.
But no, I've not had any verbal fisticuffs or anything else with anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something I discuss that much either.
Do you resist talking about it? I mean, in general, obviously you're doing oral history now, but I mean, in social situations,
really.
It just doesn't really come up.
I don't
up.
Avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something I go out, I'm a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah, what did you do?
I'm not a member of the VFW. I'm not a member of the American Legion. I don't go down and march on Memorial Day or on Veterans Day.
Have you been involved with any veterans organization?
No.
Why is that, sir?
Oh, what little I did can't compare to most of what those people did. The poor guys that went and fought in the mud were the true heroes, not us. I just did a job.
Sir, is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview that we haven't covered yet?
No. I think that's given a blow-by-blow description.
Yes, sir, and I want to thank you for your time. Thank you very much.
Well, you're quite welcome. I enjoyed it.